Hey everybody, my name is Merv Lingle. I'm an alcoholic. Get
Hello.
preliminaries out of the way. My sobriety date is June 1st, 2001. My home group is the Common Solution Group of Alcoholics Anonymous. We meet on Thursday nights at Hinton Avenue Methodist. No, that's the old location. Let's see, Church of Our Savior, and it's at 7:30 on Thursday nights. You're over in Charlottesville, please stop in. A lot of familiar faces are already, coming to that meeting. And yeah, we're definitely focused. We have a speaker topic. We are solution oriented, and we're a bunch of knuckleheads too, so don't let us scare you off. And I have a sponsor. He knows he's my sponsor. I talk to him on a regular basis. Trust me, it almost seems like it's on rinse and repeat for the last 3 months. And I work with other alcoholics. Now, some of these guys I do sponsor, and some of them call me sponsor. If you don't know the difference yet between those two, just hang out in Alcoholics Anonymous and you'll figure that out. I appreciate the guys from Charlottesville coming up to make sure that I'm telling the truth today. And I'm sitting here with Pigeon Brother Billy, Sam, and Thurston. As always, good to see you. Lost a lot of weight since the last time I saw you. You're looking sharp, baby. And, the one thing I want to make sure that happens today is that you guys know I have a wonderful life today. And that the responsibility for that wonderful life is the actions that I take in Alcoholics Anonymous. And most of those are inconvenient, which means showing up to a lot of meetings that I don't normally want to show up to, right? I got a 2-year-old at the house. Like, I love them to death. I love my wife to death. And I want to spend as much time as possible with these people. And, but I'll tell you, sometimes I got to set aside my own personal needs for satisfaction in order to go help somebody else or be available to help somebody else. So all of a sudden I can show up better at my house. And it's these inconvenient actions through the last 22 something years that have brought me to the table that I might have a glimmer of a little bit of serenity. I wish I was serene all the time. I wish I was one of those people who get up here and they talk about like hallelujah. And it's rainbows and ponies, and this is not the case for me. I get a lot of that as a byproduct of selfless action, but my life, I still wake up every morning, and the most important subject I think about is myself. And that's generally how I start my day, always. And recently, I've been having a lot of talks. I've been going through a tough time. Billy knows about it. My oldest son hasn't spoke to me in 1 year and 8 months. And he's mad at dad, and his reasons are justified, and some of it's true and some of it's not, but we're not here to discuss that. I'm just here to talk about a little bit about like how I love this kid and how I think about him every single day. I talked to my sponsor about him. I miss him a lot. I wish he would reach back out to me at any point in time. And essentially he started talking to me about this daily surrender. He's like, Merv, whenever you wake up in the morning, what you got to do is you have to realize something is that you can't manage your own life and you sure as hell can't manage anybody else's either. The best you can do is help the sick and suffering alcoholics and God, please surrender yourself to thee. Take my son, please take care of him and I'll take care of your kids. And I've been doing that. And, the tension that had been on me for months and months and months has started to decrease with this practice of, offering up my son to God. And it was his 22nd birthday on Monday this past week. And I'm playing it off cool. Crystal's like, how are you doing? And I'm like, man, I'm fine. I'm fine. Right there. I'm fine. Go to a meeting, Merv, how you doing? I have COVID, but I'm fine, And my sponsor knows what's going on, but I really don't share it. And but I'm in my head. So I send the most awesome birthday card, an email, and a text, and I'm like, this time he's gonna text me back. And I got crickets. So now the fear of what my son thinks of me, the fear that I'll never get to be a dad to him, this stuff is crawling up my spine. And I'm God, I surrender my son. So I have to spend time with my youngest son, 2 years old, while Crystal's at work and daycare is closed. So first day, piece of cake. Man, we're like throwing rocks in a pond. It's rainbows and ponies, talking to sponsees all day on the phone. Beautiful day, Next day, I don't call nobody. Now I'm thinking. Just like now, it's just like, well, he ain't gonna text me, you know. Now I'm like thinking, and whenever I'm thinking, that's not good. You don't want Murph thinking in your house. It's kind of like Chuck going on a cruise. You don't want that either. And what ended up happening was, is like my youngest son, he's finishing up his slice of pizza. Beautiful day, not a cloud on the horizon. Throws that plate down, staring me in the eye, throws it down and breaks it into like a bunch of pieces. Not 0 to 100, but about 0 to 80. I'm right about here. And I'm like, I just beeline over and I get the vacuum cleaner. I pick up some pieces. I'm like, hey, buddy, you need to, get back in your room. We don't throw things. And you need to sit in here until I clean this up so you don't cut yourself. And I'm picking up the plates and I'm get out the vacuum and I'm vacuuming, And all of a sudden the vacuum gets caught on the plate and I'm pull that plate out and then it gets caught on the rug. Bam. 22 years sober sponsor now, more than two handfuls of guys going to so many meetings a week. I take that vacuum cleaner and I go outside and I launch that son of a bitch down the driveway until it's rolling down the hill, hanging on by wires. So I just want you all to know that, imperfection is part of my story. I strive for the ideals. Whenever we reach in the 12 and 12, it talks about reaching for perfection, but by understanding that we will no means achieve. And I'll tell you, like, man, sometimes life just gets the better of me. So that's who you got up here tonight, right? And if I look at it, the way fear has run my life, because it used to be behind a wheel. Like fear was behind the wheel of my life all my life. And now it pops up, and whenever it pops up, it's manageable by God, sharing it with other alcoholics, maybe a possible inventory, and a whole heck of a lot of prayer and meditation, right? It gets me to act right. It saves you from Merv, right? But early on in my life, like long before I took a drink, Bob D often talks about being a freeze-dried alcoholic, right? Like he just needs that drink long before he had it. And that was me. Because, like, when I was running around as a kid, I was obese, lived most of the time in a trailer park. And I was going to a school where everybody either was getting dropped off in, like, Mustangs or, like, we're going way back. They didn't have like super nice fancy cars like we do in Charlottesville now, but really nice things. And everybody had money, everybody had nice cars. And right away, the fear of what other people thought of me got a grip of me. And I didn't know how to handle that. So how I normally handled that was I kept you right here. And I was a shy kid. I didn't talk to nobody. I didn't do nothing. And pretty soon I became the kid that people like to beat up on the playground until I started punching back. And once I started punching, I couldn't stop. And I didn't know what that was about. I got sent to like see people about this stuff. I was always a kid trying to like punch holes through cinder blocks. I didn't know how to control this. Like I didn't know what it was. I had anger issues. And the truth of the matter was I was scared to death. I was scared to death of what you thought of me. I was scared that I would never measure up to you. I wanted what you had, and it was just like I was just a train wreck of a kid. And growing up, like I tell you, I had nips. Or, I mean, I had a blackout at like 8 years old. I don't tell this story too often, but I'll tell it tonight. I had three older sisters, and two of them graduated high school. And they were twins. And my parents, being nice parents, decided, hey, we'll have the party at our place, but nobody drive. We're going to make a safe environment. And they bought me an 8-pack of Malt Duck. And they said, Merv, you can have as many of these as you want, thinking I was going to have like maybe, or whatever. I'm 8. So I'm like sitting there on the picnic table drinking my malt duck, and I'm looking around. There's my sister and all her friends over here in one group, nursing their beers. And then there's all the guys over here in their group nursing their beers. And all of a sudden, this motorcycle pulls up. And off gets this guy with a leather jacket, there's sunglasses. His name was Steve. Man, I'll never forget Steve because Steve walked right up and didn't pay no mind to nobody. And all of a sudden, all the girls were talking about him, and all the guys were fetching him beers. Now, I'll tell you, long before the effect of alcohol came alive in my life, I knew right then and there what was missing in my life, and it was that. The center of attention.
Yeah.
The one everybody flocked to. Like, to be that guy. And I'll tell you, I went on to drink the blackout. But I'll never forget it. Like, one of the last things was, like, I'm sitting on this picnic table, and this Steve guy comes up to me, puts his hand on my shoulder. He's like, "Hey, man, you drink like a man. Why don't you come hang out with us?" And I went over there, and I mean, I'm 8 years old, right? They were probably just making fun of me the whole time. But after, like, waking up in my own vomit, my parents like, "Ah, ha, ha," and I'm like, "You bet I don't want that stuff no more," And that was the truth for a long time. I went along, and I just suffered, like, in my own head with, like, my surroundings. I mean, thoughts of killing myself, like, were on me at a very early age, because it was just like I wanted to connect with something, but it was like I didn't know what I was doing. Like, I didn't have any connection with my parents. Like, I intellectually loved them, and I knew they loved me, but I didn't know what that was about. I didn't know if I was doing it right. I thought it was just like the solitary, like, person living in his own imaginary world. And I mean, I made up stories. I would just lay in bed after school and just imagine myself, like, in a camp in Montana fighting zombies. And that was my only release from this. And until I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I didn't know this was the bondage itself. Like, I've been living in that for a long time. And my mom used to throw alcoholic around, like everybody was an alcoholic, right? And she got it right with my grandfather. Like, 3 out of 4 of my grandparents drank themselves to death, right? And then my grandfather moved down with us. And, I mean, he was yellow. He was going to die. He was on it. He was on his last turn. And, he was the alcoholic of the Hopeless Friday because his life was on the line. And he could not stop drinking. And my mom's plan for him to try and control his drinking was to send me to the bar with him over the weekends, so he would, like, hopefully not drink too much and get Merv home alive, right? And I'm, like, 13, 14 years old, and we go rolling into, like, it's 11 a.m. to the Milroy Hotel in, like, bum F Egypt, Pennsylvania, right? I mean, there's no sunshine because all the windows are painted black. You go in there, it's musty. It's exactly what you're thinking. And we sit down at the bar, and we're not the first ones there. There's people just sitting around. And nobody's looking at nobody. I will never forget it. I saw Joanne C., because she used to be an old neighbor of mine, across the bar holding her hand steady to get that stuff in her. And I'm sitting there like, holy smokes, man. Like, if I were to turn out to be something like this, man, I mean, I need to shoot myself. And what would happen would be, after they get one or two of those things down, somebody put a quarter in the jukebox, somebody put a quarter in the pool table, and all of a sudden, the place would come alive momentarily. People would laugh. They would tell jokes. And it was like Night of the Living Dead. And I was like, what is going on here? And what I was witnessing was at least the illusion of the effect produced by alcohol. Right? Because I know what the illusion looks like. And it's just like, and I know what the effect produced by alcohol looks like. And these guys were all at the end of the rope. So anyways, there was a lot of scary rides home, a lot of grandpa puking on himself, like running off the road in the ditches. I mean, it was ugly. And then he drank himself to death. And I got to watch it real close up. And my mom used to call my dad an alcoholic too. Now, my dad, who, was my hero, he was always under a car, always had grease up to his elbows. He was always doing something. He's actually like a folk hero in my hometown. And dad, mom called dad alcoholic, and he was one of those guys that kind of looked like us, drank too much, there was plenty of times I'd have to call mom to come pick us up, whenever we went out for dinner or something like that. And, him and mom would get into big fights and then he'd run off to Philly for like a year, and then he'd come back and say, "I'm done drinking." And then sooner or later they'd fight again and get drunk. But the day came, and this is like at the end of my drinking. The day came where they found a spot on his liver, and his first grandbaby was born, and he stopped drinking. He didn't have a drink. He died without having another drink. And what ended up happening was after a week of suffering, he even had DTs. After a week of suffering, he didn't go to AA. didn't go to church, didn't go to shrink, didn't do nothing, just shook it out and toughed it out. And then he became happy and sober. He took care of my mom, and I'll tell you what, he led a great life after he stopped drinking. He did so much for so many people and didn't do anything, just white-knuckled it, and then all of a sudden he was okay. Man, I locked that away in my keen alcoholic mind when I was, like, drinking, right? Oh, if it ever just gets bad enough, I can just stop. See, my dad had a drinking problem. He wasn't an alcoholic. He was the heavy drinker that the big book describes who can recover on a non-spiritual basis. And the thing is, there's a big difference between grandpa and dad, you know? But I didn't know it. They were just all alcoholics, right? So I'm just observing. So the day came, like, you know, my three older sisters were all home at the same time, and they wanted to go out. I'm 16. I got my Plymouth Scamp. I got one friend, you know, and I hate my life. All I do is just play baseball and play sports, and I hate my life, and I hate everybody around me, including my parents. And we went out, and they were like, hey, we just want you to drive us. We just want to go down to this place, listen to some music. We're not going to get drunk. Just hang out for a little bit and then give us a ride home. And so I go down there and I'm like, yep, you know, and the bartender, they all get their drinks. And the bartender comes up to me and measures me up and down. And she's like, all right, big boy, what are you going to have? And for some reason, double Jim Beam and Coke came out of my mouth. And we all have that moment, right? We all have that moment. And that moment came alive for me. And it's always been described as the world went from black and white to Technicolor, or however you want to put it. But what happened was, is I laughed. I laughed for real. And all of a sudden, that backpack of bricks of life and self-obsession I'm wearing dropped off me. And I had some hope. I had some hope. Hey, you know what? Life might be okay. When Bill Wilson talks about his white light experience in, you know, in his story, you know, sudden and profound change. That was not my spiritual experience, but I'm going to tell you what, alcohol gave me a sudden and profound change. You know, that was on the target. I hit the bullseye dead center and I changed. And what ended up happening was, is I chased that stuff from that point forward. And it was like, whenever I could get it, I could get it. And what ended up happening was at 16, I started getting served everywhere. And I was a guy. All of a sudden, if there was a keg party, call Murph. And I'd come to the keg party. People would gather around. All of a sudden, you know, like, it became, what alcohol did for me was it kept, like, it changed my perception of the world for a little bit. And that effect that it gave me, like, lasted for a little while. But really what it did for me was it turned this lonely kid thinking about suicide on a daily basis. And all of a sudden, you know, I'm voted most likely to succeed. I had the prom queen for a girlfriend. And, you know, and I don't know, my life just changed. It was like, I can't explain. And my mom loved it because all of a sudden it seemed like Merv could come out and come out of his shell, you know, and I did in a major way, you know. And I thought about this today. It was like my sponsor talks about three phases of drinking. There's fun with problems, and then just problems, right? And my fun without problems lasted maybe 9 months, you know, and fun with problems started like right away. Cause I mean, I had 6 underage drinking fines and before I was 21. And I'll tell you, like, they were just bumps in the road. And slowly as this drinking progressed, it went from like, yeah, I feel alive and I'm the king of the party. I'm Steve, you know, and all this type of stuff. And it slowly started to take over. And drinking the way I wanted to drink played a very important role. And whenever that came up to me, there's things that need to go to the wayside in order for me to drink the way I need to drink so I can at least get near the dartboard again. And college was one. I dropped out of Penn State after 3 semesters. And pretty soon what started to happen was I started getting a litany of things in that back closet of my mind. You know, I can't tell nobody about prom night, right? Meanwhile, you know, I'm berating my mom, saying if she would have raised me better, I wouldn't have turned out like this. You know, where in the hell is dad at? You know, screw him too. you know? And man, now I'm drinking and now I'm all alone again in this show. And man, things just started piling up, you know. Next thing you know, my dad like reaches out to me. He's like, "Hey, I understand you're going through a tough time. Why don't you move up to New York with me?" So I go up to New York, and you know, the old adage, and I've done this rinse and repeat so many times in like in my drinking, I'm gonna reinvent myself. I'm gonna go up there this time. Like I know what kind of like what a straight like looking hardworking guy my dad is. I need to become like that. But sooner or later, I'm alcoholic. Like it's gonna tell on itself, and it did every time. And it wasn't like, you know, like, yeah, I got a DUI 2 days after I turned 21 in New York. I'll tell you what, getting your butt searched in Poughkeepsie Prison was no fun. But that wasn't enough to scare me off. You know, like all I did was just find another way to manage my drinking. And what that showed up as is like I started getting a lot of girlfriends. "Hey, will you drive me here? Will you do this for me?" And then all of a sudden, I'm back to the old behaviors that Merv had before, which is like, you know, I keep one here and I keep one there, and then there's always two back here type of thing going on. Then they all find out, and then all of a sudden my double life is exposed because they collide with each other, and then there's the truth. And whenever the truth pops up, what's Merv do? I hop in my car and it's time to take a ride. And then I'm off somewhere else. Next thing you know, I'm in Savannah, Georgia, open up Savannah's first punk club, you know. And once again, I'm reinventing myself. I'm going to be the small business entrepreneur. You know, I can get Jane's Addiction for 3,000. I can do this. I can do that. I can do this and do that. Took 9 months. 9 months. Till I'm stealing from another job, sleeping with another person, a couple more things in that back closet in my mind that I can't keep closed anymore, right? And I do this medley, this change of scenery to try and reinvent Merv and avoid the double collisions of life. And I end up in Charlottesville, and I'll save you all the drama. And I'm in Charlottesville. I'm managing a bar, and I am like, you know, I know at this point drinking is a problem, right? I know it because I can't stand myself when I'm not. Like whenever, you know, at this point, Dad stops. "Okay, if it gets bad, Dad, I'll put the plug in a jug, and my life will get better," you know. And there were points where I really wanted to stop, and those were quickly washed away by the night, by the next bright, shiny thing, which was generally her money, right? And then once I start drinking, I make bad decisions, you know. And when you're drinking around the clock, that just means there's bad decisions all the time, right? And I'm working here, and in walks this cocktail waitress, new, and she's scared to me. Why is she scary? She's beautiful. She has a college degree. She's going for a master's. She works at the biggest law firm in Charlottesville. She's not like me. She plays violin, first chair, second row in the UVA Symphony. She has it together. She already has a 401k. And I'm looking at her, and she's scary, but I fall for her immediately. And I'm sure there was a lot of third column instinct satisfaction that was going to be brought about by this. But I didn't know at the time. I just was like, "That's her. That's the one. That's the one that's going to help fix me." And took her on the first date, took my whole bar staff down to Smith Mountain Lake. She comes along, and I'm already like not drinking as much as I normally need to because I have to like at least look like I'm like a capable human being, right? So I'm sitting once again on the picnic table. I get a Rolling Rock, I drink half of it, bang. Put that son of a gun right there. Let it get warm. Every time she comes in off her jet skis, I'm like, "Oh, my beer's warm." Oh. Meanwhile, I'm sitting on the cooler beside me with Jägermeister in it on ice. And when she ain't looking, man, I'm hitting, right? And long story short is I finally decide to go in the water. I get on a jet ski. My good friend Derek's behind me. I fall off the jet ski. I come up out of the water and he hits me going 50 in the head. You know, two stories. I did die on a helicopter ride to Roanoke Memorial, and the other one is like I didn't. But the one thing I do know is whenever I came out, whenever I came became conscious 2 months later, who's sitting in a chair beside that hospital bed but that girl? And the first thing I say to her isn't, "How are you? What happened? You know, thanks for being here." The first thing that came out of my mouth was, "I can't drink no more. I can't drink no more." And I meant, like, I've never had a more solemn oath in my life. And she's like, oh, don't worry about it. Like, you can get some help. You got to get out of here. You got a plate in your head, you know, like your eyes shut. You're going to be like, if you can see, your jaw is broke and five places are going to be wired shut for a year. Why don't you just heal and get some help once you get out of here? And I got out. And then 2 days later, I'm stealing liquor out of a friend's liquor cabinet and I can't figure out why. And I look back at it and I know why. It's because I'm not my dad. He stopped drinking and he was fine. When I stopped drinking, man, my life's putting screws to me. Because now that closet door back here, man, that thing's open and it's flooding out. I mean, I'll tell you, when I'm just not drinking, you want to talk about, you know, the horror show of a life. I know it because that's all I'm thinking about every night when I'm not sleeping until all of a sudden it's like, you know, 11:30 and I have to go down and get a case of beer at a convenience store so I can get to sleep. And man, that was rough, you know, but I put on a good show for a little while. We got married, you know, and there was a lot of like fixing Merv involved in this. I kept thinking, all right, if I get the trophy wife and the picket fence, you know, I get all this stuff and then maybe it'll fix me enough inside. I might be like my dad. I might be able to just slow down my drinking. And I got all that stuff. I got it all. Had it all. And it was the worst time ever. Like, I kept chasing. And then, okay, then there's got to be a next thing, you know. And I kept accomplishing all these things that I thought would fix me. And at the end of the day, all I was doing was just putting the screws to her. Because half the time I'm coming to meetings of AA, but I'm not getting a sponsor. I'm not doing the steps. It's like James B. says, you know. You know, the first thing you guys tell me to do is get a sponsor, join a home group and take the steps. And it's the last thing I do. Right. So I'm in here in and out for 7 years, like doing MERS program, which is basically just sitting there taking up space. And man, dude, I suffered more in that 7 years coming in and out of the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous than I ever did from the consequences of my drinking. Because now I'm just holding on. And when I'm just holding on, man, that thing's going and it's going. Now all of a sudden it's like prom night, you know, man, my parents, they ain't talking to me no more. Well, maybe it's because, you know, of all that stuff you said, no. They just hate me because I'm a loser, you know? And I mean, all this madness. And the only thing that would ever calm that down was the illusion that this time it's going to be different. See, I know last time what happened whenever I drank, whenever I said I wasn't going to drink, you know, I slept with the wrong person in the marriage. That's what happened. This time it's going to be different. This time I might be able to get the dart on the dartboard. You know, I might be able to be happy drinking again. And the thing is, that's the illusion that always took me back out, was this time it's going to be different. This time I might get the effect that it gave me whenever I was, you know, 16, 18 years old. And man, alcohol is a lying bitch, man. It is. And I'll tell you, every time I like went, you know, after about four or five, it was exactly like Bill says. I'm pounding on the bar like, man, how'd it start? Because I already know once I start, I'm off to the race. I'm going to show up in a different state punching out a windshield. That's how I roll whenever I drink, you know. And you know, I love those people coming to AA who say, you know, I only hurt myself. I want to go up and strangle them, you know, because I'll tell you what happened to my wife is when she finally had enough guts to throw me out and take control of her own life, she ended up having to go to like a psych ward for 2 weeks for the behavior and the silent scorn and all that stuff I did to her, you know, and that is something that's still like, man, I feel lots of shame about that. And so anyways, like she leaves. I have one friend. He's like, you can sleep on the couch. I'm like, okay. And, you know, and I sleep on the couch. And I figured this time, you know what? She's not looking over my shoulder. I'm just going to get her done. Let's just see what happens. That lasted 3 or 4 days. And because I showed up twice in jail, right? And to jail, I have a commitment in on Wednesday nights. And I'll never forget it. You know, like I take that drive all the time, you know. You know, AJRC, down the hill, up the hill. And I got out of jail. And getting out of jail is nothing new for me. I know how to get out of jail, you know. And I've been in and out of AA long enough. And there was a person that I hated in AA because they were talking about all the stuff I wasn't doing. You know, they were talking about hunger. They were talking about sponsoring people. They were talking about taking the steps and paying the money back and all this stuff. Man, I hated them. There was a couple, and just didn't like them. And but I'll tell you what, whenever I got out of jail that last time, I went down to the convenience store about halfway to Charlottesville from the jail, and I got a 22 of Bud Light, and I sat behind that dumpster, and I tried to choke that thing down. And I'll tell you, I couldn't choke it down. I just spit it back up on myself. And something happened. And it wasn't a white light experience or anything like that, but what it was the internal truth, the realization that, man, I'm never going to get back there. I'm never going to get back to being 17, 18. That ain't happening no more. My life's never going to get any better. And all of a sudden, you know, it's just like in the book, it says, in the last analysis, that's where we find God. So, you know, in the beginning was the last analysis, it was Alcoholics Anonymous. And not just showing up and being a spectator, but actually being a participant. So I called up that person I hate and I said, hey, man, I was just like, I heard you speak 2 weeks ago and you said that you could never drink again if you do certain things, and I need to know what they are. And it was just like a repeating record, sponsor, home group, take the steps, work with others. And I said, all right. You know, and I went over to their house and they started talking about, you know, we started right with the book. We started talking to, you know, reading the doctor's opinion. You know, what's the first thing an alcoholic gets back, right? It's their opinion. And it didn't take long, like, you know, one day. And they came and picked me up. I picked that white chip up at the 5:30 speaker meeting and they came and got me. And we started reading the doctor's opinion. I was like, oh, yeah. Once you start drinking, you can't control the amount. And that I knew. Like, I knew that. I knew that about myself. I'm like, all right, smart guy. How come it is that every time you burn your life to the ground, you always go back to it? And for that, I didn't have an answer. And when they started going through that and then describing the thoughts and feelings of the insanity of the first drink, like that, like you're going to come apart, like you want to kill yourself, like you're losing your mind. And I'm sitting there like, holy smokes. Like, that's what I got. And I was like, that's what I got. And they're like, congratulations. You just might be an alcoholic of the hopeless variety. And the good news is there's many of us here. And we have a way out. We have a way out. And they made it real simple for me. They said, Merv, if you want to get sober, the easiest way to look at it is get a sponsor, say yes to your sponsor, and say yes to AA. If you can do that, you got a fighting shot. And then it's on you to give it your best try ever. And I said, I can do that. And I gave it my best shot ever, you know, and it was enough, you know, like, I mean, there were so many points in times, like in early sobriety, like where, you know, that, you know, say yes to AA stuff. Like, I mean, it came into play, you know, like now all of a sudden, you know, I'm at step three and I think I know what it means, but man, I don't know nothing, you know. My now sponsor is a circuit speaker up in Jersey, you know, and we're like talking on the phone and trading emails. And I think because I just went through like a 120-page workbook that I know what I'm talking about, you know, and I make sure everybody in AA knows what I'm talking about too. You know, that's some lonely business in AA. Like if you got your badge on, man, I recommend taking it off as soon as possible. And but that's who I was, you know. I'm like 3 months sober, you know, and I'm like telling everybody what they're doing wrong in AA. Like, I'm an idiot, man. I'm an idiot. I'm like, no friends in AA, you know. And I got my little coffee commitment because coffee makers make it, you know. It's the noon JPA meeting. And I'm, you know, it's at the end of the meeting, somebody makes an announcement and they're like, you know, I got to go on a 12-step call. I need somebody to come with me because you never go alone. And you know, that was it, right? So I'm like, I go back to cleaning my coffee pots up, and that guy comes up. Murr. It's just like, nobody's coming. You got to come with me. And I'm like, what? You know? But it was like, all right, say yes to AA. All right. Yeah. Okay. I don't have anything better to do. All right. You driving? All right. That's good. Because I don't have a license. And so, anyways, we go over to the hospital that I actually work at now, UVA. And we check in, we get in the elevator, whole way up the elevator. I'm like, man. I need to get a job back because I lost my job at the law firm the first day I was sober. And they didn't want me back. I got to find a job. And man, I need a new girl and I need a new picket fence. And you know what? Like all that's there's some of that stuff I might tell on my fifth step because now I'm him hauling around on my fourth step a little bit. There might be some stuff I'll share, but I don't know about mom falling down the stairs and prom night's pretty sketchy. And I go up there and it's just me in the elevator. No one, and all of a sudden we get there and we sit beside this guy who's yellow, my grandpa. And he looks like it was just coincidental, but he looked a lot like my dad. And this guy's like talking about shrinking, trying to 12 step him. And the guy's like this. And all of a sudden he looks over to me and I'm like, AA works, because I don't have anything else to say because I really haven't done anything, but that's all I got. And I'll tell you, that guy got sober and he stayed sober until he died. But the way down, that was a different person. I was a different person. I was like, yeah, you know what? Like, yeah, man, I should just put it all down. I should put it all down. I'll just keep going to all these meetings, Like they told me 90-90 was for wussies. You don't have a job, you can make 270 and 90. And that's what I did. And it gave me some hope. Because what it did was is it cleared up this erroneous mess enough for the truth to come in. And that is a privilege today. Like today I heard two fifth steps. Man, and all they're doing is just telling me about me, And I'll tell you what that does is like it gives you guys a better version of Merv. Because this is not clouding my judgment. I don't have these thoughts, feelings, belief systems that are creeping back up from the ego and my unsatisfied instincts dictating what my reality looks like. What it is, it's the truth. It brings me back to the center. And anyways, so I went through with it. I wrote all that stuff down in the fourth step. I got real clear. I was a liar, cheat, and a thief. They were very detailed. I wish I was one of those guys, like some of the guys I sponsored come to me like with a four step on a bev nap, or like it's written in a spiral and they're reading it like this. Like I wish I was one of those guys, but I wasn't. I did a very detailed and thorough four step. And there was a lot of truth. I saw what, I saw who I was. And they made sure to tell me that that's who you were. Because right now, with God's help and the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous and a lot of service, you're going to change from that, just like the third step promises you. You will change. And I went along with it, And I called up a Jersey sponsor guy and I said, I'm ready. And I was. He said, all right, I'm going to fly down to Dulles Airport. You drive on up. We're going to fifth step in the chapel. So I drive up to Dulles Airport. Well, I got a ride. And he flew down and we went in there. There were people in the chapel. So we had to go in the closet in the chapel. And I'm sitting on a mop bucket, like fifth step, right? And it was just like what everybody says, Like I'm sitting there and he's like, all right, just, get it out, get that stuff out first. And I told him. And he just nodded his head and smiled. He's like, oh, yeah, welcome to the club. Welcome to the club. And as we went through that fifth step and he would share back with me, I started to not only had I identified with my drinking, but now I identified with alcoholism. The fear, the instincts running wild, dictating all my behaviors, and just like the selfish actions of I need more all the time. And man, I was just like, God, yeah, I guess alcohol is just but a symptom because that's what I really got now, and that was nice. Like I heard it loud and clear and I got it, And I, went back, I did six and seven, didn't really have a full understanding about like what to do with any of that stuff. And he proceeded to tell me after I botched my first three amends, that I need to get a sponsor in Charlottesville. Because he couldn't like you need somebody close because you just blew your first three amends. And I did. I blew it with the ex-wife. I couldn't keep my mouth shut. I had a yeah button there. And she said, your amends to me is you never talk to me again. I'll reach out if I ever want to hear from you. And I haven't heard from her. And then I blew up my workplace with two amends. And then I was so I went shopping for a sponsor. I went through five guys in Charlottesville. I didn't know what to do. And then finally somebody said, you need to go down to Buckingham and talk to this owl guy. And I'm like, okay, so I go down to Buckingham and I meet up with Al and he's not there. He's like speaking somewhere. So then I go back and he's like, yeah, we'll talk about it. We'll talk about it. And, you know, he started to ask me questions about where I am. I showed him my men's, my ASAP list, all this stuff. And he was like, all right. He's like, now tell me about your home group. And I was like, well, I got a clean that coffee cleanup commitment, but I'm really not part of the home group. He's like, oh, you need a home group. And I'm like, okay, you know. So Buckingham at that time was 90 minutes. Billy knows he used to drive farther than me. And I go down there and I'm sitting down there. It's all these flannel wearing guys talking about bow hunting and fishing. And I'm down there, I'm hip slick and cool, baby. You know what I'm saying? And I'm just like, you know, after about a month of this, I'm like, ow, you know, I'm not connecting well with these guys. And he's just like, well, that's because you're expecting them to connect with you. That's not your job. What you're looking for, you're looking with. And what you need to be doing is if you want people to connect with you, then you got to be willing to connect with them. That means it's your job to reach out to them first. You need to build a connection. That's not their job. It's your job. And what ended up happening was, is like, you know, all of a sudden Billy's easy to talk to, but Alex D wasn't, you know, and some of these other guys weren't, you know, but I started practicing that. And the funny thing is like 22 years later, if anything happens, I know who has my back. You know, I know it's those guys. And he taught me a lot about the power of the hunger, you know, and James, my friend, once again, he says this all the time, and it's so true. Is that the steps will get you sober, but the relationships you build in Alcoholics Anonymous will be what keep you sober. And man, the longer I'm sober, the more I believe that. You know, and you know, just to talk a little briefly about the changes in my life with what 10, 11, and 12 mean to me. Very personal stuff, you know, and so before I committed to a relationship with my present wife. I'm looking back because I had that son. Like, I got in a relationship. She was 15 years sober. I was 3 months. We had a kid. I stayed in that relationship way too long. I caused too much pain in their lives because I just didn't know what. And what it was she was my higher power. And then all of a sudden, through steps and progress in Alcoholics Anonymous, things shifted. And when people lose that higher power, privilege, you start to notice what's wrong with them all the time. And I couldn't shake that. And I didn't know what to do with that. And what I did was I stayed in that relationship too long until I exited it very poorly. And, you know, and I went to Al, you know, and I was like, oh, I can't go to these meetings. All she sponsors like 30 people, you know, like I can't go to that meeting. I can't go to that meeting. And he's like, oh, yeah. He was very nice when he told me to shut up. And he said, listen, what you're going to do is you're going to go to those meetings. And what you're going to do is you're going to go to more. He's like, Merck, this is going to blow over. The only thing that's going to make this a big deal is you. What you need to do is stay consistent in your meetings and let God work through those meetings in your life. And I showed up. The only person who was thinking about me was me, you know? Like, I got some cold looks, but that's fine, you know? And what ended up happening by adding these extra meetings was I got like 5 to 7 new sponsees. And I'll tell you what, those guys saved my life. They saved my life, you know, because like, I'm like, you know, once again, I need to get money. All of it comes back. Fear rides up just like with the vacuum cleaner. Those unnatural instincts, those things that demand attention in my third column of my resentment inventory. When I get fearful about one thing, those things light up. Man, it becomes serious that all of a sudden that those are the things, the satisfaction of those instincts, sex checks and self-importance might be the things that make me walk out of here one meeting at a time, because I've watched over the years many times. And so what I did was I knew that there was this nice young lady and now I've been like, you know, single in AA. Once again, bad habits, you know, not directly with anybody in Alcoholics Anonymous, but a lot of bad habits outside of Alcoholics Anonymous. And man, something had to change. And what ended up changing was I went back through the inventory, and whenever the conduct inventory asked me those specific questions of like, all right, you know, what could you have done different? How could have you been giving, honest, selfless. And what I did was I answered those questions wholeheartedly with God's help. And I got a good vision of like, this is what maybe a spiritual Merv should look like, because that's your sex ideal. And then Merv, we need to pray every day. We need to grow towards this. And what ended up happening was, is it became a piece of business in my life. The sex ideal coupled up with the 11 step, and then my 11 step changed. It was no longer like I'm going through the paces so I can sound good. It became a heartfelt adventure, and it just changed my life. And it wasn't like I felt like any closer to my creator, because God's right here, right now, anyway. It's just a matter of how awake I am to it. But I became a little bit more awake at the wheel, you know, especially in that. And what ended up happening was is that stuff carried me through, and it still does. That is still a piece of business in my life, because her well-being and of that child is far more important to me than how I think, feel, or believe. Far more. And it saved the world from Merv again. And the great news is like, you know, this combination of 10 and 11, you know, it I don't know about unshakable, you know, like whenever I was getting ready to launch that vacuum cleaner, I wasn't there pondering, I wonder what God would have me be, you know, like I wasn't doing that, you know, like, but that's a question I ask myself a lot, you know, especially now with the fear of my son, 56 with a 2-year-old, you know, like I just got all kinds of fears rolling, you know, and every day I got to ask myself in morning meditation, what would God have me be today? You know, God would have me take care of God's kids. God would have me show up despite how I feel, keep my commitments in Alcoholics Anonymous, return a phone call. That's what, if I do that, my life out there is going to be just fine. Because it's still all dependent upon the selfless acts in the, you know, what I do in here. And how I know that is because, like, I've tried the other way, and I'll tell you, I'm a wrecking ball. I still can be a tornado, you know, in Alcoholics Anonymous. And, you know, working with other alcoholics is a beautiful thing. Like, I don't need to talk about that too much. But, you know, my sponsor always talks about this thing, you know, and it's like my fifth step's incomplete until I hear yours. And, man, that's so true. When I'm sitting there today, you know, there was no, it was just flat tire stories, right? You know, it wasn't anything stupendous, you know, but all they were doing was just telling me about me, especially after my week. Got a little bit more glimpse of like how fear shows up. And then when I was able to share that stuff with them, like I was able to reveal more truth through that sharing, that connection process than I could just sitting around meditating on it. And that's a beautiful thing, you know? I'm getting there. So I'll go ahead and I'll finish up. And in a roundabout way, whether you're new, up to no good in sobriety, or you're running full steam ahead and life is great, you know, I always remember this, and a lot of you guys have heard this, so I'm sorry. But there was a time like when my oldest son, he was like 5 years old, and I would have to take him to preschool at Waldorf, right? And it was awesome. Right. You know, take them to preschool, Waldorf. And, you know, I could always build better puppets and stick figures than any of the kids. So I was like, you know, felt pretty good about myself. And it was fall time. And what I started noticing is we live in this forest of poplar trees and they're all like this rusty yellow, ugly color, you know. And I'd go out every morning and be like, man, you know, because I generally take meditation and calmness outside. And I'm like, man, look at these ugly trees, man. These things are so ugly. Meanwhile, the neighbors all have like red maples and everything's like, oh, look at that. Oh, and I'm like, man, these trees got to go. So I don't, you know, tell her, I don't tell the sponsor, but I go buy a chainsaw and a couple extra blades, some extra chain. And I'm like, okay, I'm going to take them to preschool and then I'm going to knock them out, pull them out, and I'm going to start cutting all these trees down, you know? So sure enough, you know, I decided we need an extra long way. So we go out near Crozet, and we're taking this back way to Earliesville. And if you've ever taken that drive, it's the most beautiful drive next to going to Sperryville in Virginia. And man, I'm looking around, it looks like God's watercolors everywhere. And I'm like, man, this is so beautiful. And then I'm like, those ugly yellow trees, man. I can't wait to get home. Well, I'm about like half a mile away from my house. And I look across the field and I see this thing that it's the most beautiful thing I've ever seen. It looks like a yellow bouquet of flowers in the distance. And I'm like, God, that place is awesome. Well, by the time I get to my driveway, I realize that bouquet of flower trees is where I live. And I'm like going down the driveway and I'm like, oh man. You know, and Neil said they didn't chop anything down, you know. But what that does is like it reminds me that Alcoholics Anonymous, it's long. Sometimes that long way around. But the long way around through the steps, through selfless acts, keeping your commitments in Alcoholics Anonymous, sooner or later, you know, what looks like the ugliest thing on earth will become one of the most beautiful things. You know, and that doesn't matter for me. All that take it to the grave stuff I was never going to share, that's all useful stuff now. And even more importantly, the shortcomings in Alcoholics Anonymous, working with a bunch of guys, doing all this stuff, and still showing up, throwing a vacuum cleaner outside and letting it roll down the driveway. I know that's going to be useful. I know it will. And I'm going to be honest, like all the lying, stealing, and cheating I've done in sobriety has become a more useful tool in working with others than any of that stuff when I was drinking. You know, so I'm glad to be here today. I appreciate y'all having me. And as always, it's really great to see y'all. I love y'all.